In 2003, Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón indicted 35 for alleged terrorist activities, including Abu Musab al-Suri, whose real name is Mustafa Set Mariam Nasser. Al-Suri's training methods in Afghanistan are referred to in Garzón's indictment. Mustafa Set Mariam Nasser, Abu Musab al-Suri, is a Syrian citizen, nationalized Spaniard. He became the emir, leader of a Syrian group associated with al-Qaeda, becoming a member of its council, or shura. Set Mariam first met with bin Laden in Afghanistan in 1988. When Set Mariam arrived in Afghanistan, he immediately set up a Mujahideen training camp for al-Qaeda. Set Mariam received militants and Mujahideen converts from France, Italy, and Spain, whom he would train at the camp. Once training was completed, these European Mujahideen would return to their respective countries. There, they would reintegrate into society, while really acting as sleepers, and would await orders from al-Qaeda. When al-Qaeda moved to Sudan in 1991, al-Suri, Set Mariam, stayed in Afghanistan, traveling sporadically to Khartoum. He moved to Spain in 1995, and later to the UK. Vahid Modjer published an insider's account of his time as a Taliban official, Afghanistan Under 5 Years of Taliban Sovereignty. Extracts from the book, which appeared in the Dari language in late 2001, follow. It shouldn't be assumed that al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was a coherent and flawlessly efficient organization, or that every Arab volunteer was one of their affiliates. Osama's spiritual influence was not so great as to gain the absolute obedience of all. Abu Musab al-Suri was also among Osama's opponents. A naturalized British citizen, Abu Musab had come to Afghanistan from the time of jihad against the Soviet Union. He always advised the Taliban to stop Osama's actions because he was sure that Osama didn't know what he was doing. The dispute between Abu Musab and Osama reached a point where Abu Musab said in an interview with the Al Jazeera television network that their relationship had ended. After the fall of the Taliban, Wall Street Journal reporter Alan Cullison purchased a used computer in Kabul, which turned out to be one of al-Qaeda's main computers, a computer often used by Ayman al-Zawahiri himself. Together with his colleague Andrew Higgins, Cullison deciphered nearly 1,000 documents stored on the computer, which were often encrypted or written in code. The results of that investigation were published in the Journal and later in The Atlantic. One of the documents on the al-Qaeda computer was a letter from Abu Musab al-Suri to Ayman al-Zawahiri, dated July 19, 1999, an excerpt of which follows. "The strangest thing I have heard so far is Abu Abdullah bin Laden saying that he wouldn't listen to the leader of the faithful, Mullah Omar, when he asked him to stop giving interviews. I think our brother, bin Laden, has caught the disease of television screens, flashes, fans and applause." Noman bin Othman, the Libyan who fought with al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. "Before 9/11, al-Suri and bin Laden hated each other. Al-Suri didn't like bin Laden's leadership because he said bin Laden is a dictator, and he even called him a pharaoh." Vahid Modjer, the former Taliban foreign ministry official, describes the increasing radicalization of the Taliban leadership in 2001, evident from its campaign to destroy Afghanistan's cultural heritage. Omar's order about the destruction of the Buddhist statues in the Kabul Museum in the spring of 2001 was absolute, but it was meant to be a secret to avoid broader worldwide attention. All hopes of preserving the objects faded away. Taliban officials went to the museum to execute the order. The museum door opened, and the group, each armed with a stout club of some kind, entered and hammered the statues while uttering the phrase, "God is great." Mullah Omar's order of the destruction of the Bamiyan statues was announced on February 24, 2001. They are Afghanistan's most well-known monuments, two statues of the Buddha, hundreds of feet high, carved from cliffs in the 3rd and 5th centuries AD. Despite exhortations from the world community, including many Muslim nations, the Taliban would destroy the Buddhas with artillery and explosives in May 2001. Maulana Mutawakkil was then Foreign Affairs Minister in Kabul. The morning after the issuance of the order, I visited him in his office and found him depressed. He said that he was informed of Mullah Omar's order the day before and had spoken with him on the phone. Mutawakkil was more open-minded than many highly positioned Taliban. Knowing Mullah Omar, Mutawakkil was well aware that the order would definitely be carried out, and the efforts of the international community to avert his decision were futile. The destruction of the Bamiyan statues inspired feelings of hatred and disgust worldwide towards the Taliban. Foreign forces in Afghanistan, including the Arabs and Central Asian fighters, however, were most satisfied by the destruction of the Bamiyan statues. One of the people defending the Taliban was Sheikh Mahmoud Ukala, a blind Saudi spiritual leader. He was among the most highly honored Arab clerics, and considered by some as the successor to Sheikh Mohammed bin Baz, the former Saudi Grand Mufti. He is the same person who approved the 9/11 attack as a retaliatory measure taken by Muslims and openly admired the persons who planned it. Many cassette tapes of Sheikh Ukala's lectures were sent to Kandahar praising Mullah Omar for his conduct. Ukala also wondered why it took so long to destroy the statues. In response, Mullah Omar ordered 100 cows to be slaughtered and the meat distributed among the needy throughout the country to make up for the delay. That cows had to be slaughtered carried a political meaning. While Buddhists all over the world condemned the destruction of the statues, slaughtering 100 cows totally enraged the Hindus against the Taliban. It was said that the expense for the animals was paid for by the Al-Rashid Trust, an ostensibly charitable organization in Pakistan. I heard from some Arab fighters and Taliban officials that 1 month after the Bamiyan incident, the number of Arab volunteers joining Al-Qaeda and the Taliban troops in Afghanistan was 10 times that of the previous months. One of the documents recovered on the computer purchased in Kabul by the Wall Street Journal reporters after the fall of the Taliban was a letter from bin Laden to Mullah Omar. "I pray to God, after having granted you success in destroying the dead, deaf and mute false gods, the Bamiyan statues, that he will grant you success in destroying the living false gods, such as the United Nations." Fahid Mojeh explains that the Taliban regime sustained itself through a campaign of endless war, yet it was also riven by internal disagreements, not least of which was what to do with bin Laden. The Taliban leadership had no plan but war. Their military commanders enjoyed unlimited power. In the early stages, the Taliban treated their war captives in a humane manner, and in several cases, commanders released them after taking their weapons. Taliban military commanders only reported to Mullah Omar. In addition, military commanders never reported their financial activities to any office. Naturally, with such power and authority to wage war, they never desired that peace be established in Afghanistan and, as a general rule, opposed any peace initiative. The Taliban were also ruthless torturers. Their most commonly used technique was beating people with electric cables. One of the more interesting Taliban initiatives in the area of diplomacy was the oral order issued by Mullah Omar in 2001 regarding the ways in which diplomatic communiques with foreign governments were to be handled. Even though the Taliban did not have formal diplomatic relations with most countries, their foreign ministry on the occasions of birthdays or deaths of foreign leaders sent congratulatory notes or messages of condolences to these states. Mullah Omar ordered that no leader of a non-Muslim country should be sent a congratulatory note on his birthday. No nation suffering from natural disasters such as a flood or earthquake should receive a message of solidarity or sympathy, since these are acts of God. Further, no non-Muslim foreign leader should receive a message wishing him a long or healthy life. The Taliban was not free of internal disagreements. The disparity reached a point where Mullah Omar had to encourage these factions to set aside their differences. In his letter of advice, he noted that, due to certain tensions, the future of the struggle is at risk. Each man talks behind the back of the other, and the leaders more than the rest. Many of these differences had simply to do with people and differences in tastes, but some were of a more fundamental nature. The most important figure in this regard was Maulana Mutawakkil. After Mutawakkil took the job of foreign minister, he tried his best to perform differently, but the situation with Osama bin Laden had really tied his hands. He believed that if the Taliban wished to be accepted by the world community, they should not take actions that would antagonize it. For this reason, while he was in Kandahar, he ordered that Osama be placed under surveillance and not be permitted to do whatever he wished. When Mutawakkil took charge at the foreign ministry, he asked Mullah Omar to restrict Osama's activities more closely. Osama used to say about Mutawakkil, "Two entities are against our jihad. One is the U.S., and the other the Taliban's own foreign affairs ministry." In 2000, bin Laden's attention turned to Yemen, his ancestral homeland. Al-Qaeda would plot to blow up U.S. warships there, while Al-Qaeda's leader would take his fifth bride, a Yemeni. Abu Jandal, bin Laden's Yemeni bodyguard. Regarding Sheikh Osama's marriage to his latest wife, the Yemeni Amal al-Sada, my mission consisted of taking the dowry from Sheikh Osama and carrying it to the bride's family. The Sheikh gave me $5,000 and told me to deliver it to a certain man in Yemen, and that man, in his turn, took the money to the bride's family. I did not know at that time that the money was a dowry for Sheikh Osama's bride. I found out later. When I decided to return to Afghanistan, the brothers asked me to take Sheikh Osama's bride and the male relatives accompanying her with me. I waited for 2 more months in Yemen for that purpose, and finally I could wait no more and I left. The bride and her male relatives followed me 1 month later. We held a splendid wedding ceremony for the Sheikh in Kandahar, in which his wives and children participated. Songs and merriment were mixed with the firing of shots into the air. From what I know, she is still with her husband, Sheikh Osama, in Afghanistan. On October 7, 2000, two Al-Qaeda suicide bombers piloted a bomb-laden skiff into the USS Cole, a U.S. Navy destroyer refueling in the Yemeni port of Aden. The bomb blew a hole the size of a small house into the hull of the ship, killing 17 American sailors. That attack came a year after a similar failed attempt by Al-Qaeda to blow up a destroyer, the USS The Sullivans, also in Yemen. Abu Jandal was bin Laden's chief bodyguard at the time of the Cole bombing. He explains Al-Qaeda's rationale behind the attack. "Actually, there are several reasons. The first is to break U.S. prestige in the sea and raise the morale of the Islamic nation by saying that its sons can deal blows to the enemies of the nation wherever they may be, on the land, in the sea, or in the air. It is to say that we can face the enemies even with individual capabilities. Take the Islamic world, which consists of about 71 states. It cannot say no to the United States, but we individuals can do so. They proved to the Islamic world Muslim ability to break U.S. prestige and hegemony over Muslim shores and sea. This was the main reason for choosing the U.S. destroyer Cole for bombing. Otherwise, there were many ocean liners. But the choice of the best destroyer in the U.S. Navy was intended to be a slap in the face for the United States. It was to tell the United States that we can deal it a blow whenever and wherever we want." In November 2002, the United Arab Emirates arrested Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri. Nashiri, al-Qaeda's commander in the Arabian Peninsula, led al-Qaeda's attack on the Cole. Nashiri, a Saudi, is currently held by the United States at an undisclosed location. Based on its review of U.S. interrogation reports of Nashiri and other al-Qaeda members, the 9/11 Commission constructed the following profile of him. Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri, the mastermind of the Cole bombing and the eventual head of al-Qaeda operations in the Arabian Peninsula, appears to have originally been recruited to his career as a terrorist by bin Laden himself. Having already participated in the Afghan jihad, Nashiri accompanied a group of some 30 mujahideen in pursuit of jihad in Tajikistan, a country that borders Afghanistan in what was once the Soviet Union. When serious fighting failed to materialize, the group traveled to Jalalabad and encountered bin Laden, who had recently returned from Sudan in May of 1996. Bin Laden addressed them at length, urging the group to join him in a jihad against the Americans. Although all were urged to swear loyalty to bin Laden, many, including Nashiri, found the notion distasteful and refused. After several days of indoctrination that included a barrage of news clippings and television documentaries, Nashiri left Afghanistan, first returning to his native Saudi Arabia and then visiting his home in Yemen. There, he says, the idea for his first terrorist operation took shape, as he noticed many U.S. and other foreign ships plying the waters along the southwest coast of Yemen. Nashiri returned to Afghanistan, probably in 1997, primarily to check on relatives fighting there and also to learn about the Taliban. He again encountered bin Laden, still recruiting for the coming battle with the United States. Nashiri pursued a more conventional military jihad, joining the Taliban forces in their fight against Ahmed Massoud's Northern Alliance, and shuttling back and forth between the front and Kandahar, where he would see bin Laden and meet with other mujahideen. During this period, Nashiri also led a plot to smuggle four Russian-made anti-tank missiles into Saudi Arabia from Yemen in early 1998. At some point, Nashiri joined al-Qaeda. Nashiri traveled between Yemen and Afghanistan. In late 1998, Nashiri proposed mounting an attack against a U.S. vessel. Bin Laden approved. He directed Nashiri to start the planning and send operatives to Yemen, and he later provided money. Nashiri reported directly to bin Laden, the only other person who, according to Nashiri, knew all the details of the operation. When Nashiri had difficulty finding U.S. naval vessels to attack along the western coast of Yemen, bin Laden reportedly instructed him to case the port of Aden on the southern coast instead. The eventual result was an attempted attack on the USS the Sullivans in January 2000 and the successful attack in October 2000 on the USS Cole. Nashiri's success brought him instant status within al-Qaeda. He later was recognized as the chief of al-Qaeda operations in and around the Arabian Peninsula. While Nashiri continued to consult bin Laden on the planning of subsequent terrorist projects, he retained discretion in selecting operatives and devising attacks. In the 2 years between the Cole bombing and Nashiri's capture, he would supervise several more proposed operations for al-Qaeda. The October 6, 2002 bombing of the French oil tanker Limburg in the Gulf of Aden also was Nashiri's handiwork. Although bin Laden urged Nashiri to continue plotting strikes against U.S. interests in the Persian Gulf, Nashiri maintains that he actually delayed one of these projects because of security concerns. Those concerns, it seems, were well placed, as Nashiri's November 2002 capture in the United Arab Emirates finally ended his career as a terrorist. Abu Jandal. Al-Qaeda pursues a method or principle that calls for centralization of decision and decentralization of execution. The decision was made centrally, but the method of attack and execution was the duty of field commanders. For example, the persons who were in Yemen, like Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri and others, took part in this operation. They planned for it, and God granted them success in its fulfillment after a long watch. The planning for Cole operation was carried out by the people on the ground. The idea was formed, and the target was set, and then it was referred to a higher military control committee in al-Qaeda called Military Affairs Committee, which does not plan but gives the green light, the support, and the funds for these operations. But the planning, execution, and method of attack were all undertaken by field commanders in the operations field. A few weeks after al-Qaeda's attack on the USS Cole, I traveled down Wadi Doan a 100-mile-long valley in the Yemeni region of Hadramaut, on a road that was little more than a riverbed to reach Rubat, the bin Laden family ancestral village, which is at the very end of the wadi. The wadi, with its looming cliffs and rocky outcrops, reminded me strongly of Afghanistan. Indeed, the trip to Rabat is reminiscent of the trip to Tora Bora from Jalalabad, with the difference that in Wadi Duan you are aware that you are in a desert region. Women swathed in black, wearing conical hats of straw, worked the fields of the wadi, figures that seemed to have stepped out of a medieval painting. The bin Laden village is comfortably tucked into the shade of the wadi cliffs. Rubat's genial mullah, who runs a school out of the old bin Laden family compound, told me, "We are against this holy war. The coal attack does more to harm Yemen's reputation than America's reputation. We feel sorry for the American boys and girls. They are our guests." Khaled Al-Omeri, a 30-year-old cousin of bin Laden's who owns a food shop on Bin Laden Street, avoided direct questions about his most famous relative. But when asked about his view on jihad, he pointed proudly at his 3-year-old son, saying, "This is my jihad." A month after the Cole bombing, Ahmed Zaidan, Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Pakistan, received a summons to speak to Al-Qaeda's leaders, who privately admitted they were behind the attack. "November 2000, somebody called me and said, 'We need you to come to Quetta, Pakistan. We have good things for you.' We then reached Kabul, where I met Osama, who told me, 'Of course we have a lot of things which we disagree with Taliban, but they are better than other Afghan groups. There is no anarchy in the country.' And then I told him, 'Okay, so if you disagree with Taliban with different issues like women, so why are you not coming out to clarify your position?' 'Because many Arabs don't like this rigid policy by Taliban.' He said, 'This is not our concern. Our concern is to fight Americans or to fight the Westerners.'" Most of the viewers of Al Jazeera, they think he is only just talking about religion. No, it's not true. He is using religion to prove his ideas on current affairs or interpret current affairs according to religion. Osama was sitting, and I wanted to go to the bathroom. And I go to the bathroom, and bathroom was occupied, and I came back. And he gave hint to his people, said, "Okay, check whenever this bathroom is free." And really, after only just a few minutes, somebody told me, "Okay, it's free." And Osama asked me to go. It was some sort of human touch. I disagree totally with the people who are saying that he is under the influence of Ayman Zawahiri. Not at all. Osama bin Laden is very confident, and you can see from his body language when he is talking. For example, when he's reading in Arabic, he is perfect. I can't maybe prove it, but he wants to project himself as little bit different from al-Zawahiri, and my feeling is that he is always keeping little bit distance with al-Zawahiri. And if Osama is trusting somebody, he was so much trusting Abu Hafs, the Egyptian military commander of al-Qaeda, who would be killed in a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan in November 2001. Abu Hafs joined al-Qaeda and became al-Qaeda totally. He is very quiet, and you feel that he is planner, very well organized and smiling all of the time, reading a lot, knows what's going on in the world. He was very much futuristic. I still remember when he told me things as if he is reading the future. He was telling me in November 2000, after I finished my interview with Osama bin Laden, he said, "I will tell you one thing. We did the USS Cole attack and we wanted United States to react. And if they reacted, they are going to invade Afghanistan and that's what we want. We want them to come to our country. And then we know that they would have bases in Pakistan, in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. And they are going to hit Afghanistan from these countries. And then we will start holy war against the Americans, exactly like Soviets." So then al-Qaeda called me again on January the 26th, 2001. I was preparing to go to Hajj with my wife. Every year my wife is waiting to go to Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. And the problem is, you know, we are journalists. Always something happens. Always something. Only 6 days left for Hajj, and my wife said that I'm sure that we will not go this year. I said, no, we will go. Then I got the call from Al-Qaeda. I was feeling selfish at that time. We drove to Afghanistan, Kandahar. I was thinking that we are going to do interview with Osama bin Laden. Instead, this wedding party took place, and it was wedding party of Osama bin Laden's son, Muhammad, who was marrying Abu Hafs' daughter. And it was really interesting to see how they are making their wedding party. More than 400, 500 people were sitting just like in a row, just like they are praying. Didn't take much time, maybe 1 hour. And then food, and then serving fruits. Mostly Al-Qaeda, few Taliban. Osama bin Laden and Abu Hafs were there. I have a video camera with me. Of course, the main thing in this type of wedding party, the bride was not there. And then Osama bin Laden, usually he is giving like poetry. He doesn't give speech. He tried his level best to make some poetry, and he failed. He gives his poetry, and the people say, Allah Akbar, God is great, encouraging him on. Then we finished the wedding party, and he said, okay, come with me. And we went into his room in his house. And we sat there and started to talk, and he said, Ahmad, I don't think my delivery was good. And he's very much caring about public relations, very much caring how he would appear on the TV. And he said, I didn't like it. I'm going to deliver it again. And he did it. And he came out, and then he was comparing. He said, no, no, the first one was better. The poem he delivered was against America, of course. And he was very much praising the USS Cole attack. Osama bin Laden's poem, celebrating the attack on the USS Cole. A destroyer. Even the brave fear its might. It inspires horror in the harbor and in the open sea. She sails into the waves, flanked by arrogance, haughtiness, and false power. To her doom, she moves slowly. A dinghy awaits her, riding the waves. The reference to the dinghy is to the skiff that the Al-Qaeda suicide attackers used to blow a 40-foot hole in the coal. Ahmad Zaidan. Osama's brother Hassan was there. He is a very nice person. You know, this family is very articulate. And then bin Laden said that my mother is here and my brother is here. Osama said that I am very much feeling guilty. If there is no United Nations embargo on Taliban, I could bring special plane for her to take her from here directly to Saudi Arabia. He was a little bit upset, saying, I'm not so kind to my mother. Osama's son, Osman bin Laden, aged 8, delivered a speech honoring his father at his brother's wedding. It was recorded on videotape, excerpts of which follow. How can anyone blame my father or hold him accountable if he endeavored to instill in one and all a feeling and desire to stand against the might of the kafir, the infidels? My father raised a voice and urged the Muslims to unite against the infidels. My mother taught and instilled in me an unending, everlasting feeling that I should always be motivated to fight and die for the glory of Islam. I stand for a jihad against kafir today, and shall so do till eternity. Jihad is in my mind, heart, and blood veins. No fear nor intimidation can ever take this feeling out of my mind and body.
This ends Disc 9.